Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. The new Northumberland County Archive and Museum got a big boost last week when it received its first private donation towards its operation. Stuart Richardson, a local businessman, historian, and philanthropist, gave $85,000 towards the main exhibition gallery. It will be named in his honor. In this interview, you will hear from Richardson about his donation. You will also learn about his passion for local history and the many projects, big and small, he has worked on over the years. A lifelong resident of the village of Hastings, he will share memories and stories from the past and present. I am so pleased to have with me today Stuart Richardson, a businessman and philanthropist, and Northumberland County Archive and Museum archivist Abigail Miller. Welcome to you both to Consider This Northumberland.
Hi, thanks, Rob.
Glad to be here.
I want to start with you, Stuart. What made you decide to donate $85,000 towards the new Northumberland County Archive and Museum?
Well, I've always been fascinated in local, and by local, I mean Northumberland County, Indigenous and colonial history. And over the years, I've been into the current archives quite a bit, back and forth, doing some research on a few of the books I worked on, as well as a couple of articles. And so I've got to know Abigail and Katie fairly well, and I've seen firsthand the services they provide, not only to people like myself, but also the local historical societies. And when I was talking to them about a year ago, I think now, and I found out they were building a new archives and museum within the confines of the new Golden Plow, that led to more discussions. Just something I believe in. And I thought, oh, what the heck? There's worse ways to spend my money. So I made the commitment to them.
How did you come to the decision? Did you talk with anyone? Did you consult with family? Did you come to it entirely on your own? How did that work?
I had a long talk with my wife, as you could appreciate. We've been involved in a few other philanthropic events or projects. She knows I love history. And when I told her what I was thinking of doing, she supported it. She thought it was a good idea because I think partially because she's a teacher, she's a retired teacher now, but over the years, she's seen how hard some civil servants work. And as I've said to Abigail and Katie in the past, part of the reason I'm doing this is because of how hard they work, and I see their commitment to it. So I guess to answer your question, I just went over with my wife and she was supportive of it.
Now, there are lots of historical organizations that you could have donated to. Why specifically an archive and a museum? Why is that particularly of interest?
Well, I'm a member of three historical societies in the county, Hastings, Campbellford, and Colburg. But this is a little different. Firstly, those organizations tend to, do okay. I've never been treasurer of any of them, but from what I've seen at annual meetings and that sort of thing, their scope and their objectives are fairly straightforward and small compared to what this new facility is going to be One of the things that really excites me about it, Robert, and I'm sure Abigail will give you better details, is that it's going to be, I guess, what they call a Category A archive and museum. And I had no idea that what this does, and I've had a quick construction tour, so I have a better feel for this now, seeing what they're doing, the HVAC systems and the collection hall. This will allow her team or their team to bring in exhibits from anywhere in the world, if I'm not mistaken. So a year from now, we could be, you know, they can be maybe advertising that come up and see an exhibit from Britain or goodness knows where. And so that really excited me long term.
How did you become interested in history?
Well, I wasn't the strongest student in the world. I went to school at Hastings Public School and then over to Norwood. But history was one of those. My father was in World War II, as was my uncles on both sides of the family. So I kind of grew up with that in the background. I would say that's pretty well it. It was the one subject that I really did well in and have always liked.
Why is history important to a community in your mind?
Well, some would say it's not as important as it should be, or certainly wasn't important as it used to be. But we all hear stories of museums that aren't doing well and that sort of thing. But it's funny. I saw a saying the other day. I'm not big on sayings, but I've got a couple here. Well, this one is, our past has a lot to do in shaping who we are today and the things we pursue in life. Now, that comes from Bruce Springsteen. He said that the other day in something I was watching about a new album he's releasing. And so I think that kind of sums it up nicely.
Why are archives an important resource? You use it, and obviously quite frequently, but for somebody who's listening, why do you think an archive is an important resource?
Well, one of the things Katie and Abigail do that your listeners might not be aware of, I certainly wasn't aware of it till I started going in frequently. I'll give you an example. I came across an old GOAD Atlas, G-O-A-D, and that's this company back in the day would come into villages and do a survey of the villages and literally right down to color coding the type of building, cement, wood, and then they would turn around and sell them to the insurance companies and also to the villages. And I had one of Hastings. Now, it's been sitting in my office here for years, and I realized that's not a good thing if something ever happened to me or whatever. So Abigail and Katie were glad to get it because no one had the Hastings one. There's various ones out there, and I know they didn't have it up at Trent University either because I've given them copies since. But so there's so many things that people might have in their homes, whether they're documents or objects. Again, I'll let Abigail speak to this, that they, hopefully I'm right here, Abigail, in saying you will come out to people's homes or apartments and sit down with them and go over what they've got and basically tell them that is something that the archives might be interested in having, donating. Because as you can imagine, Robert, things happen in life, you know, and people might just think that those old papers or those old objects are junk. And with this new 6,000 square foot building in the collection hall, we're now going to be able to keep that for future generations.
That's interesting because I was going to ask you as a follow-up to that, what is the significance in your mind of a museum in a place like Northumberland? Like we think of big cities, Toronto, Montreal, New York, museums make sense. But what about a place like Northumberland? Why is it so significant for Northumberland?
Well, we have museums in Northumberland, as you know. You know, we have the Cook Sifton Museum, which I support as well. But I just, again, being a big fan of history and feeling that, you know, history does matter, that having a world-class museum where things can be stored properly and categorized properly, not to mention bring in these other world-class exhibits, really adds to our quality of life. I know it's very liberal arts, but I believe we need more of that in this day and age.
Before we go too far, I would like to bring Abigail into the conversation. Abigail, could you give us a synopsis of the events leading up to the creation of this new museum and archive, just for maybe listeners who don't know the background?
Sure. So we really came on board to the Golden Plough Lodge redevelopment project around 2017. And so at that time, plans were being drawn up and, needs assessments were being struck. And at that point, the archives was already full. We were working with very limited space, knowing that we wouldn't be able to collect for very much longer. And so with the redevelopment project kind of already, chugging along, it was seen as an opportunity to join those two projects together. It's a cost-effective approach, and as well, it lends itself to really innovative new opportunities to partner with the Golden Plough Lodge, offer intergenerational programming between our institutions. It's very unique for the residents of the home to be able to be so close to a cultural hub. The two things really actually work very well together, even though, up front, it's kind of like, oh, that's a curious thing to have an archives and museum with a long-term care facility. But we're excited for the different opportunities that will come from it. It was really from that, just the need for a place to properly exhibit our collection, store our collection, and make the materials available to the public in a facility that's, properly climate controlled and has the space to do that safely.
Can you remind us of the date for the opening?
Oh, we don't have an exact date yet. We will be excited to put that out in the public as soon as we know. The facility is still under construction. There are many things to happen before, we can open to the public. So we need to get the collection in there. We're also going to be installing the new inaugural exhibition. There's many little cogs kind of working at the same time. We are hopeful that we'll be in by the end of September. But certainly, by the end of the fall this year, I don't want to make any real promises, but we're remaining flexible, basically, Rob, but we'll let you know the date as soon as we know it.
I understand there's going to be a special event for the opening. For those listeners who may not be familiar, can you explain what that is? Because it's kind of interesting.
Sure. So our inaugural exhibition is called Gadina Wendeman, and it means all our relations. And so it's an exhibition that celebrates Mishisagig, the local dialect of Anishinaabemowin. And so this exhibition is one that has been, we've been planning this since 2019, actually. It's got long legs as well. It's being led by a group of Indigenous advisors, really, who are just powerhouses in language revitalization work. They've been leading this all along the way. That's going to be, our big splash to the community. And so we'll at once have a grand opening just to show off the whole space. But this new exhibition is going to be something that's going to draw people from all over the place, because it's something that is just, it's featuring the artwork of James Monkman. He's a digital artist, and it's so contemporary, and it just connects really with the heart of the language. And you can tell how much thought has gone into it from the people involved. We're really excited to be able to launch with those two components.
How did you learn about this donation?
If I may, Stuart, Stuart had come into the archives and had just very subtly stated that someone was interested in supporting us, and would we set up a meeting to kind of discuss that further? And Katie and I were both like, yes, of course, that sounds wonderful. Love to discuss anyone who values what we do and wants to support it. And at the time, Stuart didn't say that it was him. In fact, that was actually, looking to donate. But yeah, during that second meeting, he kind of came clean and said, look, donor's me. So, how do we make this happen? And of course, from there, we got the ball rolling, and of course, we're going to try and find any way to make the donation process as easy as possible.
How is this donation significant from your perspective?
Multiple ways. I mean, first of all, just the fact that anybody, is willing to put up their own private money towards of supporting the archives and museum, that means a lot to us. It shows that, this is valued in the community, and that we are serving the people that we really want to. The Archives and Museum is here to be a resource for the community, and to see the community kind of reflect that back to us and appreciate it, it means so much. And of course, $85,000 is a significant amount of money, and that we are able to put it directly into the development of this exhibition, is huge. This project has been a reconciliation project from the beginning. But it's certainly one that is far beyond anything that the county's done on this scale to put up the staff resources and the monetary resources towards it. Because we're doing it at such a grand scale, we need the support of everyone we can. And so that makes it a special as well.
It is my understanding that it is part of a larger fundraising campaign with a goal of $300,000. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. So, so far the exhibition has been supported by Canadian Heritage. It's been funded partially by the Government of Canada. Cameco has also provided a generous donation, and then Stuart's contribution has all gone towards that. But overall, there is still a $300,000 gap that we would be looking to in order to fund some of the AV equipment, the traveling components, and just the artist's work that is going toward this project. And so that's basically where that money would go.
Stuart, I'd like to come back to you for a moment. You were born and raised in Hastings. What was the village of Hastings like when you were a kid?
Well, it was really idyllic because almost right out of a movie, there was a... we went to the Hastings Public School. Back then, there was a Catholic school. And we went to the United Church. I say we, my wife and I. And everybody, a lot of the other kids went to the Catholic Church. So there was... I say that because it was a real thing back then. But then once you all start playing sports and get a little older, then it all goes away and you all become great friends. It was a great place to live. My dad ran the liquor store for 38 years. My mother was a registered nurse in Camelford Hospital. And they worked hard. I have three older sisters. I was the youngest. And for me, it was a great spot. I mean... I was active in sports, and when back then we went to Norwood High School. During my time in high school, the younger kids coming into grade 9 started to go to Camelford then. That's why now all the kids in Hastings go to Camelford. But back then we went to Norwood, and we used to call it Snorwood High, but it was a great high school too, small. Teachers all came from Peterborough, more or less, and would commute in every day. But, life was good. Looking back on it, I mean, what I got from it the most are all our neighbors. We lived on the road over towards leaving town towards Norwood, and some of our neighbors were not as lucky as our family. I grew up with those kids, and it was just really... It was good, a lot of good life lessons looking back on it. So, and being one of the most beautiful villages, I think, in Ontario on the Trent River there back then, tremendous amount of people from Ohio would come up in the summer. So it was a real tourist town as well, more so than it is now. But long answer, but it was a great spot to grow up.
You certainly had an interesting childhood. Can you tell us the story of the bank robbery?
Yeah. When I was four, my mother took me downtown. My sisters were all at school, and I guess put her check in the bank or my father's. It was a Wednesday, I believe, because the liquor store was closed. When we walked in, it was just my mom and I, and one other person to our right. And next thing you know, three guys come in and locked the door behind her and yelled out that the bank is being robbed and brought the manager out. And I know all this through my mother in articles I've read. I do remember actually someone with a stocking on their face. It's the only memory I have. Oh, and I also have a memory of my mother running to lock the door after they left so they wouldn't get back in. And not about 10 years ago, I decided just to write a little story, and they published it in the Trent Valley Gazette there in Peterborough. It was a fascinating story because it was the biggest news in the village for years, as you could appreciate. There's a lot of side stories to it and humor. For example, when mom ran to the door and yelled out, "The bank's been robbed," she was yelling across the street at Jim Blackburn, who was working cleaning a manhole cover, while Jim was also the police constable. So he threw the shovel at the car as they roared by him, heading south across the bridge. And that was lampooned in the Toronto Star. It shows a picture. I still have the Toronto Star. It shows a picture of a policeman kind of dressed in with a hat, but also his workman clothing, throwing a shovel at a car as it sped away. So anyway, it was a good story.
What influences did your parents play in your life that you would say is reflected in the values and life you live today?
Well, hard work. I mean, I can remember Dad taking Mom over to the Camelford Hospital at 11 o'clock at night because they'd take me. I was that young, I had to go. And then sometimes picking her up in the morning, driving her back because Mom didn't drive. And, you know, I have, like a lot of people, I blow hot and cold, but I have a deep respect for civil service through that. And quite frankly, through people like Abigail and Katie. And so I think that's the biggest thing. They were hard workers, and they were very good people and very generous people in and around the community, especially Mom being a registered nurse. She was often called upon to come out to families with the only doctor to tend to people if there's car accidents and that. So I think those are the biggest things I take away from it.
Now, you were involved in local sports in your youth. What did you play?
Oh, we always played baseball and hockey. And then Hastings brought a lacrosse team in the early 60s, the Hastings Legionnaires, which, great story. Within 3 years, they won the Minto Cup, which is emblematic of Canadian champions. So as young kids, we all got lacrosse sticks through the Legion. We all got sweaters. We all had little house league teams. We all learned how to play lacrosse overnight. Most of the players were from Peterborough, but Peterborough couldn't find a sponsor. So the Hastings Legion stepped in. And throughout the 60s, it was the place to be on Saturday nights in the summertime, what would be to attend a Hastings Legionnaire game.
Now, did you play sports all or most of your life? And what were you involved in other aspects of local sports?
Well, I think I'm very normal when it comes to that. I played hockey, baseball. Hastings always had good fastball teams, and I was fortunate enough to be on a couple of Ontario championship teams there. As I got older, like most people, I don't play anymore. I golf now, and that sort of thing. But pretty normal sports-wise, wasn't that great at anything, but had fun playing everything.
Now, sports plays a big part in your later life as well, as you are the author of at least two sports-focused books. Can you tell us about those two projects?
Right. Well, Dick Clapper is, for those that don't know, was one of the first player to go directly into the Hockey Hall of Fame. And Dick is from the village of Hastings and grew up in Hastings. And he played from approximately 1926 or 1920s. Yeah, 1923 526 right through to 1945-46. First player to ever play 20 years in a row. Such a brutal league back then. Just so very skilled. But not too many people knew much about him. And I was doing a speech at the Hastings Historical Society and on him. And I started doing research through a friend named Jim Coveney and another guy named Dave Barry, who's similar interest in, both of them are very interested in local history. And that led me to talking to someone in Boston, the curator of the Boston Sports Museum, which is quite a museum, as you can appreciate in Boston, given their rich history. And he invited me down, and I do business in Boston. So I went down, mixed business with business, and he encouraged me. He gave me all sorts of information and photos. Quite frankly, he shouldn't have. Abigail, don't give away our photos. I realized that this could be a book, a little biography. So that's what we created. I'm glad we did it. It was necessary because, as you know now, far lesser players and people have biographies, whereas Dick Clapper, if you research him, you'll find he was an amazing athlete, an amazing hockey player.
After you left school, you've ended up becoming a very successful businessman. Can you tell us about that journey and how that acumen of business has played into your life?
Well, after high school, I went out west like everybody else did back then, and then that didn't work out. So I came home and realized I needed to further my education. I didn't qualify for university because I didn't finish grade 13. I decided to go out west. But I did qualify for back then community college. So I took a course at Loyalist, a 2-year course in social work of all things, not in business. But that led to a summer job at Manpower, if you remember Manpower, where people would go to get a summer job or get a job. And the fellow that I worked with there, we got along. He was a permanent employee. I was just a summer one. We got along quite well. At the end of the summer, he said, what are you doing this fall? And I said, nothing. I'm going to go to Toronto and look for work. And he said, well, we have this extra money left over. We're looking for, you know, it's a local business type thing. Have you ever thought of doing your own business? Well, a friend of mine in Marmara and I put together a business plan for a business in, oddly enough, repairing wooden pallets, which is real sexy, and firewood. And the program was called LEAP, Local Economic Assistance Program. And it was notoriously not corrupt, but a lot of failed and misguided money went into it. I'm pleased to say we started that business and it lasted for 28 years. It was one of the few LEAP projects that ever lasted more than 3 years because it was, I think it, we weren't making canoes or candles or anything too artsy. It was just pretty straightforward. So that's how I got into business. And, but I had that social work, you know, thing going on too, because we had to hire young unemployable kids. And of course, back then, Marmon was full of them. And so that's how I got into the wood pallet business. And then I worked for a company in Tweed, which is still there. And then I started my own business. And I worked for a trade association, a pallet association, and then eventually went back into the business myself and had plants in Etobicoke and Whitby. And at one point I had 140 people working for me. So just goes to show you, and I say this to my own children, don't worry about what room you're going to get into. Just get into a house, something you enjoy doing, and then you'll eventually, hopefully, find your way.
How did you become interested in Indigenous history? Because I understand you wrote a book on the Percy Portage.
Well, we didn't write a book. What it is, the Percy Portage was identified in a great thesis by, I think there were 6 Trent University students. I think they were the first year class back when Trent was just in its infancy, or the second year. And they did this thesis on this. They were trying to locate this unknown portage. And back then, they didn't know where it was. So they did all this really in-depth research, and one of them found this old map, which I have a copy of now, which clearly identified where it was. They thought it was below the village of Hastings and then going over to Campbellford, when in fact it's above the village of Hastings and goes over to Myersburg. So really what we did with the help of Des Conacher and Dorothy Caldwell and a few others in the work with the area, we put on a if you've been to the Awe Museum in Warkworth, we created a Percy Portage exhibit. And with a lot of help from Rick, Jeff Bieber in Oliver, we were able to get some rice processing paraphernalia. We had maps. We had the Canoe Museum got involved in it. We had a really nice exhibit. And it was really well attended because it struck a nerve up there. It wasn't the history classes, for example, at the elementary school would come to that. We had a lot of people showing up to the Awe Center that had never come in. They meant, maybe not so much into the arts, textile art and that sort of thing, but they would come for this. And so after that, we decided, we should have this acknowledged. So we did. We went to the town council, Trent Hills, and we funded just having two plaques put up, one on the corner of Richardson Road and Highway 45. They're green plaques. And there's another one down in Myersburg, just above the barn there where they have the sales every weekend. If you look hard enough, you'll see them. So it was really just an acknowledgement of what the students found back in the day in the early 70s, but it had been forgotten. And that, there's another good point, Robert, when you mention it. These kids rediscovered this significant pathway that the Algonquin Ojibwe used back in the day. And we maintained Champlain and the Algonquins went down that way on their route to the Iroquois battles. And yet it had been forgotten about. So now we hope that it's with the plaques and, of course, stuff we're giving to the archives. It won't be forgotten.
You've done many philanthropic things over time. And one of the bigger projects you helped raise money for was Ed's House, a hospice which is located just north of Coburg. Can you share how you became interested in this particular project?
Well, if there's anything I'm proud of, and I hope this doesn't sound boastful, here it does, but anyway, what the heck. My wife's father passed away at home, and it was not easy on the girls and the brother. That was his wish, and they honored his wish. Then it was all over with. I was aware of the hospice in Warkworth, the bridge, and I dropped in to see them, and then I went to see Rhonda Cunningham at the hospital here in Coburg. And I said, Rhonda, why don't we have a hospice in Coburg? And she said, well, there's always been a strong hospice movement here through Community Care Northumberland, but they've just never been able to get to first base with an actual hospice. And this is, I think, in 2016 or 17 now. Holy smokes. She said, I should really go visit Trish Baird at Community Care Northumberland, who I'm sure you know. And Trish is in Camelford. So I went up to see Trish. And I told her this is something I would commit to time-wise because I had just sold my companies. And as you know, your energy just doesn't go away overnight. So I met with their board, and my wife, Nancy, and I agreed to fund a feasibility study. And what they do with these major fundraising projects, they bring in these companies who will go out into the countryside or whatever area and determine if the community will support it. They did that. That was about, I think it was a $35,000 donation, which we gave to our Community Care Northumberland. They came back and said, yes, they would do this. The community needs a hospice, and there's enough money to do it. So we formed formed the building committee before we formed the campaign committee. We started looking for land. And so, but then we formed a building committee officially and then a campaign committee. I had no experience in campaign committee, so we were lucky to get Gordon Patty Lay to chair that. And most importantly, we were able to get Linda Kay, who had just retired from the Northumberland United Way, to come on as our fundraiser. So my accountant at the time told me he would match whatever I donated. So Nancy and I donated $250,000 and my accountant matched it. So you can imagine Robert and Abigail starting a project with $500,000 in the day. We made this commitment to community care. Well, what I've learned about fundraising is there's two sides to it. Sometimes people wonder, why do you show how much you donated in your name to it? Well, I found out from these professionals that were helping us now was that that's the best way to do it, because I struggled with this with Abigail's donation. I did not care if they used my name at this stage, but so they put your name up. So suddenly we had momentum of $500,000. And then with a strong campaign committee and a really hardworking building committee, let me tell you, they did a lot of work. Some wonderful people on that building committee. We started the process. We visited 12 different hospices to determine best practices, both in the physical design of the building and also in, of course, what are they doing that's best for the patients and their families. So I must say, I've never been involved with a group or a project in my life that was so fulfilling. We were so lucky. It just seemed every time we'd hit a roadblock, something would come along. And like for a small example, they don't extend the water into Hamilton Township anymore. And there's always been this thing, yet we were able to extend the water about 100 yards. Obviously, it was a good cause, but still, there's a lot of politics between Goldberg and Hamilton Township. Great councils at the time. Then of all things, along comes COVID. But we were able to finish the project with Dalrymple on time and on budget when everything else was going through the roof. So again, I just can't thank the committees and the people that were involved in that and the many donors who came out of the woodwork to get us up to the $10 million we needed. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I had nothing to do with it. Now, my wife, Nancy's a strong volunteer there on the garden and on the front desk. But if I'm not mistaken, I think over 300 families or individuals, of course, have used the services of Ed's House since it's been built. And I think it provides a much needed service in our great community.
You do seem like a busy guy. I look at all the things that you contribute to and all the places you're involved. And I'm just curious, what do you do for fun?
Well, I golf now. I'm very fortunate to have grandchildren now. My wife and I didn't get married till later, and we had children later. So I'm now having grandchildren later. So I still work a bit. I'm involved in a project up in Camelford. It's the Trent Hill Sports Wall of Honor. That's been a nice project. And at the new community center there, we started to honor the sports heroes up in the Trent Hills area. And that's been fun. There's so many things, as you well know, you can do if you have your health and interest.
What is one of your guilty pleasures?
Scotch.
What's next for you on the horizon?
Well, nothing. Seriously, this project with Abigail and Katie is easy. I mean, I joked to someone the other day. They were saying, "Well, good for you," and I said, "Yeah, but the check bounced." That's a joke, by the way. Sorry, Abigail, but Now, this is the way it should be, easy. And I just enjoy, I'm part of the historical societies and the Trent Hills Sports Wall of Honor group there. That's enough. That's fun. And I'm on the board of directors of the Calmaford Seymour Northumberland Foundation, which is a great organization. And it's just picking up steam here in South Northumberland. And I think that's got a lot of potential long-term for the community.
Abigail, what's next for the Archive and Museum?
Well, what's next is us moving our collection up to close to 555 Courthouse Road. We do have a new mailing address at this new site. And that is really taking up a lot of our focus now. But of course, We're always looking ahead and just being open to the public and being able to stop talking about, you know, when we're open, we look forward to inviting you in and all of that stuff. Actually just being open and having a proper space to welcome people in and just like do the work that, you know, that we love to do. That's really what's next. But, you know, we're going to have this exhibition in for 9 months. And then from there, we've got an open gallery that will be programming it with all kinds of different things. And so, you know, we're already looking ahead to plan, you know, the next use of this great new space. And so, yeah, there's so many things on the horizon. But yeah, for now, we're just so happy and pleased to be having the privilege and opportunity to move into this beautiful new space and have the support of community members like Stuart. And so we really can't ask for anything more other than, of course, anyone else who's generous and looking to support something like this. There's plenty of opportunity for that.
Robert, could I speak to Abigail's last comment there about looking for other people?
Go ahead.
The same accountant that helped me or helped us get the Ed's House going with his generous donations has a great saying, and it goes, it's better to give with a warm hand than a cold one. And I had never heard that before, and I love old sayings. And I think it's appropriate here that if someone's listening and there's many things they can donate to in our great county, but if this interests them, I would recommend they reach out to Abigail and Katie, because you can't take it with you, right?
Stuart Richardson, Abigail Miller, I want to thank you both for talking to me today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Robert.
That was Stuart Richardson, businessman and philanthropist, and Northumberland County Archive and Museum archivist, Abigail Miller. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.